Pope Francis met with comedians from around the world today. This stand-up comic from Canada commends the head of the Catholic Church for reminding everyone why comedy is important.
To be completely cliche, it really is the best medicine, and wow, do we all need a double dose right now.
I'm Carol Hills. The Netherlands has opened its first Holocaust museum, but when Israel's president, Isaac Herzog, arrived for the ribbon cutting, protesters showed up to call for a ceasefire in Gaza.
I think it's absurd that Herzog, president of Israel, committing war crimes at this very moment, is present at the opening of this important memorial.
And even with their local hero injured, NBA fans in Latvia are rooting for the Boston Celtics tonight.
Let's go Celtics!
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for joining us. Pope Francis met with leaders of the G7 in Italy today, and he warned them about the dangers of artificial intelligence. This was the first time any pope had ever addressed the group of seven wealthy democracies. But earlier today, Pope Francis met with a very different group, more than 100 comedians from 15 different countries.
Avevo dimenticato che vi avevo dato già la benedizione.
In the midst of so much gloomy news, Francis said, you have the power to spread peace and smiles. We reached out to someone who thinks a lot about humor. James Geary is the author of Wit's End, What Wit Is, How It Works, and Why We Need It. I asked him why he thinks someone like Pope Francis sees value in comedy for the world at large.
Well, I think one of the things he said in his remarks is that humor and comedy can bring serenity and a smile during a time of a lot of strife and gloom in the world. And you only have to look at the climate crisis and the wars in Gaza and Ukraine to see how gloomy things, in fact, are. But one point that I might disagree with Pope Francis on is that humor doesn't always bring serenity, nor should it. I think a good joke makes you laugh, but it also makes you think. It's a challenging experience. Laughter can be liberating, but it can also be very, very challenging.
Preparing for this interview, I noticed that there's some Irish comedians who weren't part of today's event who were sort of mad that other comedians took part in this because of the controversy around the Catholic Church over any number of issues.
Sure. And I think you could also see this as a kind of openness, a willingness to engage on the part of the Vatican, or less charitably, perhaps, an attempt to kind of co-opt comedians and to co-opt humor. But I think, you know, that's attending an audience with the Pope, I don't think necessarily means you cut back on your criticism. And it'll be interesting to see what the Vatican does after this audience. It'll be very interesting to see how the comedians who attended deal with it in their monologues, like tonight, for example, on late night shows.
And there is this tradition among comedians to punch up, to articulate the feelings and thoughts of other people.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you see the humor of, you know, the Ukrainians have developed an entire art in trolling Putin with, online memes and things like that. And humor is historically and psychologically the power of the powerless, the one weapon, if you want to put it that way, that people who don't have political or social power nevertheless can wield and wield very effectively.
Was there anyone on that list of people who were there that you were especially excited to see? Not American comedians, but other people from different parts of the world.
There were three Irish comedians invited. I thought that was really great because Ireland is a traditionally very, very Catholic country and just very recently has been addressing the legacy of Catholicism in the country. And apparently there was also a comedian from East Timor. And I think that kind of international scope and inclusiveness, I think, is really important. And for audiences who enjoy comedy, you can learn a lot about a country by listening to their stand-up comics, because those are the people who will be addressing the issues that are the hottest issues in those countries.
James Geary is a writer and a lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Earlier today, I also spoke with a comedian from Canada about the power of comedy. Deborah DiGiovanni is based in Los Angeles. Deborah, what would you say to Pope Francis if you had the chance to meet him?
Ciao, Francisco. I'm trying to learn Italian, so I would instantly infuriate him by doing that. I would be, you know, I love the dress. You look great in white, you know?
So are you surprised he met with all of these comedians of the Vatican this morning?
I am, but also when I really think about it, no. I feel like this Pope, I feel like Francis is kind of, he likes to throw us a curveball. Do you know what I mean? So I was shocked to hear it, but now that it's kind of settling, I feel like this is sort of what he does. I love it. I think it's great. I think it's weird and wonderful.
Deborah, are you Catholic?
I grew up Catholic, but then when I was about 12 years old, my mother and father found Jesus. He was behind the fridge, if you're wondering. He always is. And you never think to look there. But yes, so they became born-again Christians. So it was different. You know, we were quite devout Catholics, and then we became even sort of more devout. But yeah, Christian, like born-again Christian is a whole different kettle of fish. It really is.
So what do you think a religious leader like Pope Francis sees in comedy that's valuable and has meaning for people?
Well, this is the thing. I'm so glad that he does. And I hope that people will take his, follow his lead, because it is valuable. I was, again, telling earlier, you know, my family really, they don't agree with me doing comedy. And what a shame, because it can be excuse me, to be completely cliche, it really is the best medicine. And wow, do we all need a double dose right now? We really do. And honestly, I don't even care how you take your comedy, if you're watching it on YouTube or TikTok, or if you're going live to see comedy shows. I just feel like any way you can get it is just a good idea. We need it.
So does today's event at the Vatican affirm you in some way?
Yes, it does. It really does. Like, look at Dad. If the Pope likes it, I think you can get over it a little bit. You know what I mean? Come on. That'd actually be the best comeback for every comedian from now on. From now on, I'm starting comedy because the Pope told me to. So there you go. You can't beat that. You can't beat that for a reason. You just can't.
Well, apparently Pope Francis said today, and I guess he says it often, pray for me, not against me.
Oh, yeah. Wow, that's good. See? He might have a career on stage after this is done.
Deborah, you've been at this for a quarter century now. Is there a key to a good joke? Is there a trick to it?
There is. It's always surprise. No one should be able to finish your joke. That's the biggest one, I think. It's like when people don't see it coming, that's when you get the biggest laugh. I mean, when you figure it out too, you can still have a giggle, but when you're that surprise, that gasp of shock is really what we're going for, because, you know, it makes us feel, first of all, it makes us feel clever, but it also, it's really, I think, you know, like a jump scare in a horror movie. This is what you want in comedy as well. You want a jump laugh, I guess we'll say. Yeah, it's the best. Surprising people is the best.
Deborah DiGiovanni is a Canadian comedian based in Los Angeles. The Anne Frank House in Amsterdam is one of the Dutch capital's most visited sites. But until this year, the Netherlands never had its own National Holocaust Museum. 3/4 of the country's Jewish population was wiped out by the Nazis during World War II. That's the highest per capita in all of Western Europe. The new Holocaust Museum aims to highlight what happened to Dutch Jews. But as the World's Europe correspondent Orly Barry reports, the public opening has been messy.
The first photo you see as you walk into the National Holocaust Museum in Amsterdam is of a small boy, maybe around 7 years of age. It's a black and white photo. He's alone, walking down a road, his head turned slightly to the right. On the left-hand side of the street, stacks of bodies, some of them naked, are piled high.
It's a really shocking photograph. In Bergen-Belsen, one of the camps, the boy continued to live.
Emile Shriver is the museum's general director. The museum opens with this photo, Shriver says, because while it shows the absolute horror of the war, it's also a chance to tell the story of a survivor.
He lived a full life afterwards with a family, partly as an artist, and we show one of his self-portraits.
The new Holocaust Museum in Amsterdam has been 20 years in the works. Shriver says Dutch society has been reluctant to face up to its responsibility for what happened to the Jewish population here. Across the street from the museum, there's a former theatre where 46,000 Jews were held, Shriver says, before they were sent to the concentration camps.
This theatre across the street was also the place where Dutch who betrayed the Jews and would tell where certain Jews were in hiding would pick up their 7 guilders 50 reward for betraying a Jew.
At the museum's opening in March, Dutch King Willem Alexander did reference how many in the Netherlands turned their backs on the Jewish community.
Het Nationaal Holocaust Museum geeft slachtoffers van de Jodenvervolging in Nederland.
The National Holocaust Museum, he said, gives a face and a voice to the Jewish victims of persecution in the Netherlands, who were isolated from the rest of society, robbed of their rights, and murdered. As the king was speaking, hundreds of protesters gathered outside, chanting pro-Palestinian slogans. Isaac Herzog, the Israeli president, had also been invited to the opening.
I think it's absurd that Herzog, president of Israel, committing war crimes at this very moment, is present at the opening of this important memorial.
Among the protesters was one woman holding up a large cardboard sign. On it were the words, "This grandchild of an Auschwitz survivor says stop Gaza Holocaust." Her name is Ayella Leifinger.
My father wasn't born in Israel, but my mom was born in Israel. So it's like I was a citizen of Israel.
Leifinger moved to the Netherlands 21 years ago. That's when she says she really began to see her home country in a different light.
I was educated in a Zionist education system. My family was Zionist. So I was a Zionist, I guess.
Leifinger says she spent a lot of time reading and listening to different viewpoints on Israel and gradually became more supportive of the Palestinian cause. So much so that she started joining pro-Palestinian protests in the Netherlands and posting her views on social media.
My mom, she blocked me on Facebook. I mean, I get it. She said it's easier for her not to see it and then she will not get angry.
After the Hamas attack on October 7th, Leifinger says her mother didn't speak to her for 60 days. Leifinger's grandmother was sent to Auschwitz during the Second World War and forced to work in a weapons factory. She says they don't know much more about what happened there because her grandmother rarely spoke about it. The Holocaust Museum, Leifinger says, is an important reminder of what survivors, like her grandmother, went through. But inviting the Israeli president to the opening, that was offensive, she says, given what's happening in Gaza right now.
He was welcomed and everyone shook his hands and he was standing there to say never again, which I find so cynical.
Back at the museum, I asked director Emil Shriver if he'd ever thought about disinviting the Israeli president.
We never considered to withdraw the invitation because he represented survivor community in Israel.
And if you knew the intensity of the protests, would you have said maybe the Israeli president shouldn't come here?
No.
Later, as I'm leaving the museum, I meet some visitors who've just finished the tour.
I had to cry at a certain point.
This woman tells me her name is Femke Dane. She's from the Netherlands. She says it was really hard to see how her country facilitated the murder of so many Jews during the war. Everyone should come here, she says.
It's really important to remember what can happen if, you know, a dictator rises and if people are moved by propaganda to believe certain things.
And right now, she says, we see far-right politicians coming to power once again across Europe. I'm really afraid, she says, that we haven't learned from the mistakes of our past. For The World, I'm Orla Barry, Amsterdam.
You're listening to The World.
Hey there, I've got a quick favor to ask you. We are doing a listener survey to learn more about how you listen, what you like about our show, and maybe what we could improve on. It takes about 2 minutes to fill out, and we would be grateful if you did. You can find that survey at survey.prx.org/world. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. Thank you.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. At one time, an Iranian poet named Mohammad Shabani worked for the Iranian government. But when he openly criticized the regime, he ended up being imprisoned and tortured. Later, he escaped over the mountains and into Turkey. While in exile, Mohammad continued to criticize the government in Iran. In an interview with the BBC's Persian service, Shabani accused Iran's government of corruption. In response, Iranian agents made it clear they were watching him. They also threatened to kill him. In 2022, Mohammad Shabani died in Turkey after falling from his fourth-story balcony. How exactly this happened remains unclear. Today, we bring you the third part in our investigative series by Fariba Nawa in Istanbul. She was able to track down a close friend of Shabani's, a fellow poet named Vahid Davar. He was living in the UK, but kept close tabs on his friend in Turkey. Fariba picks up the story here.
The pressure that the regime was heaping on Mohammed, all their attempts to scare him, it was working.
Just imagine receiving threats, okay? And you are in a country in which you have no rights as a human being. You are not a human being.
Vahid says Mohammed felt more and more alone in Turkey, and so he pushed him to try something new.
Mohammed, leave your flat, go to the town, instigate conversations with people. You will find like-minded people. But he even didn't want to learn the Turkish language. He had lost all his hope. One of the saddest things that once he told me was that there was a corner shop in the area. And one day when he went there, because he couldn't communicate with a shopkeeper, he needed to put things in Google Translation and get the translation in Turkish. And after the shopkeeper spoke nastily to him, Mohammed wrote something along the lines of, I used to be someone in my own country, don't speak like that to me, and showed it to the shopkeeper, and the shopkeeper rejoined, yes, in your country, meaning, yeah, you used to be someone in your country, but you are nothing in this country.
Turkey hosts the largest number of refugees in the world, about 4.5 million people. And there's a fierce anti-immigrant sentiment throughout the country. Mohammed lived in a small town. Discrimination only isolated Mohammed more, and the strain wasn't just psychological.
I was sure that he even didn't have enough money, but he was too proud to speak about it. In literally every phone conversation that we had, I asked him, Mohammed, can I send you some small amount, very small amount? Would you allow me to do that? The answer was a fat no.
Still, Vahid kept trying.
But even when I asked, it doesn't need necessarily be money. Mohammed, I would love to send you some presents. I don't know, it's winter. I would love to send you a jacket. Please send me your address. He never sent me his address. Never.
So Vahid tried to help Mohammed in other ways.
I encouraged Mohammed to correspond with foreign embassies and consulates in Turkey. And I myself drafted some emails for him. And I drafted the emails, I sent them to Mohammed, and I asked him to email them to various consulates, to more than, 10 consulates and embassies.
Mohammed followed Vahid's advice and sent the emails. He even wrote human rights organizations long-winded explanations about his struggle.
But unfortunately, all of them were met with silence.
Vahid says this was agonizing for Mohammed, not only because he was being ignored, but because he had to ask for help.
And even for drafting those letters, he apologized a million times. I embarrassed my friend. I'm so embarrassed. I'm ashamed, my friend. I'm a mess. He kept repeating these things about himself.
Vahid says about 2 years after Mohammed arrived in Turkey, he tried to escape. In the winter of 2020, the Turkish president, in a dispute with Europe, openly encouraged refugees to flee to Greece. Mohammed was among the thousands of refugees who rushed to the border between Turkey and Greece, but he got stranded on a piece of land between the two countries. He eventually was able to return to Turkey with the help of a lawyer.
He was so hopeless about moving on and going to another country, and he didn't want to stay in Turkey anymore.
Vahid says it was clear to him that it was becoming harder and harder for Mohammed to take care of his basic needs.
One of the things he had issues with was sleeping. He couldn't sleep. He several times told me that he was taking these pills to get a few hours of sleep. He was in a very shaky, fidgety mental state in the last months.
Vahid pauses before he speaks. He has salt and pepper hair, dark brown eyes, and soft features. It seems like this is all weighing on him. He says he worried about his friend, but he was also so busy writing his dissertation. And then one day, his phone pinged.
I received a text message from a friend in Germany, and she said, they say Mohammed is dead. And then immediately, my first reaction was calling Mohammed and sending him text messages in vain, and then reaching out to some people, some friends, mutual friends in my hometown, Shiraz, to ask if it was true. I went back to my office and I told my office mates I lost Mohammed and I couldn't stay. I went for an aimless walk in St. Andrews. When I speak about myself, I need to speak about myself because these selves carry the imprints of the people we have loved in our lives. And sometimes I can acknowledge that my laughter is not my laughter. That's a loan from Mohammed. That was the way he laughed.
Vahid says Mohammed died alone, but his death was part of a larger pattern.
When we speak about this regime, we speak about a bunch of rowdies. And their first means of holding sway over people and exerting power is threat and violence. And Mohammed was not the first person who fell victim to this oppression machine. So, yes, this is emblematic of the way they treat dissidents, and they have no shame about it.
I talked to more of Mohammed's friends abroad, and they confirmed Vahid's observations of Mohammed's character and mental health. But if I wanted to know what actually happened to him in Turkey, I had to go to where he lived and died.
Reporter Fariba Nawa in Istanbul. This story is part of an investigation called Lethal Dissent from The World and our partner OnSpec. Look for the full episodes each Friday in The World's podcast feed. Next week, Fariba speaks with witnesses in the Turkish city where Mohammed Shabani died. You're with The World. Hong Kong's unique judicial system includes foreign judges on the bench of the territory's highest court. Three of them just resigned, with one giving this reason for quitting.
He reckons that we are on course to become a totalitarian state.
What's happening at the highest level of Hong Kong's judicial system? That's ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. It might be hot where you are this week, but it's probably hotter in Qatar. Temperatures in Doha reached 112 degrees Fahrenheit today. Energy is cheap in Qatar, and people have come to rely hugely on air conditioning. So much so that in Doha, even outdoor parks are artificially cooled. The World's Duri Buscarin reports.
The first time I went to the Al Saneem air-conditioned park, I showed up an hour before the AC turned on and almost gave myself heat stroke. But when I returned an hour later, that sweet, sweet cold air was ready to go, cascading through vents in the ground and from above in a lattice-covered walkway, paired with a background track of songbirds. Climate change is making summers hotter all over the world. But the Persian Gulf is heating twice as fast as the global average. So days like this are a preview of what the future looks like for all of us.
It kind of sounds crazy, having air conditioning in open space.
31-year-old engineering student Abu Sheikh Minon is running, so I join him for a bit. He's doing 5 laps around the park today, about 3 miles.
People can't be like indoors the whole time, right? So if we have some kind of air-conditioned outdoor spaces, it might encourage more people to come out even though it might seem like a waste of energy, still helping, you know, everyone to come outside and have fun.
Later in the day, laborers from a nearby construction site sit in the shade near the vents, finally unwrapping the thick cloth that they keep over their faces during work. Qatari grandfathers walk in groups, chatting, and a woman wearing a long black chador runs to pop music.
Beautiful scenery outdoors, well kept, clean, well maintained.
Barry Matthews, a defense contractor from Chicago, says it's his first time in Qatar, but he's already a fan of the park.
It's a beautiful thing. They need to contract this somewhere in the States, honestly.
Qatar is deeply reliant on air conditioning. In the summer, up to 75% of the country's entire energy consumption goes to cooling, according to Qatar Cool, a Doha-based utility. Only 12% of the country's electricity generation comes from solar power.
From a climate perspective, this is all very wasteful and troubling. But from a human dimension, you can see why it's happening.
Khalid Diab, spokesperson for Carbon Market Watch, says the Doha skyline is defined by tall glass skyscrapers and wide boulevards, designs that make cars and air conditioning a necessity. Diab says it can seem whimsical to cool an outdoor park, but colder countries use energy to heat the outdoors in the winter. Regardless of the source, the more energy we use, the more carbon emissions get pumped into the atmosphere. And as the climate heats up, the demand for AC gets even higher.
We may be seeing more and more of this. I mean, air conditioning in general has gone from being a luxury item to becoming more and more of a necessity.
After debuting outdoor cooling at the World Cup stadiums in 2022, Qatar expanded its network of air-conditioned parks, pedestrian streets, and outdoor cafes. Even the historic waterfront market, the Souq Waqif, has air conditioning now.
You know, I move out of my home at 8 a.m. It's still hot.
Nishad Safi is the executive director of the Arab Youth Climate Network. He says life in Doha revolves around the heat. People spend daytime hours inside until it's comfortable enough to emerge when the sun goes down. And in the summer, wealthier people go abroad to cooler climates.
So if there is no tech-based interventions like air cooling outside, it would be highly impossible to people to even commute, meet, or be even go out of their homes.
Safi says there are ways to do this sustainably, like increasing Qatar's share of renewable energy. But right now, a patch of AC in a big hot city is like a breath of fresh air. For the world, I'm Dari Buscarin. Doha, Qatar.
The Russian Navy is conducting exercises in the Caribbean this week, and three of its ships, along with one submarine, arrived in Cuba on Wednesday. In response, the U.S. has deployed at least one anti-submarine aircraft to keep tabs on the Russian vessels. The Pentagon also has three destroyers patrolling in the region. Dara Masico is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. Dara, what kind of ships has Russia sent to the Caribbean?
Russia has sent one guided missile frigate, they've sent one submarine, and then they've sent two logistical ships with them to help them with the deployment.
And what kind of exercises is it planning to hold in the Caribbean?
So this is a pretty routine deployment. This is the seventh one that they've done to the Caribbean since 2008. And on their way transiting from northern Russia across the Atlantic to Cuba in the middle of the ocean somewhere, they conducted a simulated missile launch. Again, that's pretty routine. They didn't actually fire a missile. And now that they've come to Cuba, they're doing a routine port visit.
So do these Russian ships pose any kind of threat?
Depending on their loadout that they left Russia with, they can carry missiles. So in terms of the capability that they bring with them, yes, it's threatening. But right now, how this particular exercise is presenting and how the Russians and the U.S. are communicating about it, this suggests that this particular event's pretty routine.
And how are the two countries communicating about it?
So if it's a normal routine training exercise, the Russians, as they have done in this example, they will communicate, these are the ships that we're sending. We're sending them to Cuba. This is part of our annual training cycle. So it's all very kind of transparent for the Russians in terms of where they're going, what they're doing. And in response, the U.S. government has said, yes, we're monitoring them. We're actively tracking them. Second Fleet, which is based out of Virginia, is going to be in the area as well as Fourth Fleet. This is routine. To me, suggests that this isn't anything that we're concerned about, like is unusual or is going to escalate in any way.
But what do you make of the timing of the Russian exercises? Is there anything about that that's worth talking about?
Yes. So I think it's important to keep in mind that when Russia sends out a surface action group, which is what this little grouping is, it takes them several months to prepare for it, for logistics and just getting everything lined up and prepared. So is it timed coincident with something large, like there's several NATO summits coming up and things like that? It's possible. But this is also a particular time of the year when, if the Russian Navy is going to do an out-of-area deployment, they typically do it in June and July because the weather's good.
I'm curious, what are the countries that the U.S. military ships visit that Russia then glances and say, oh, American ships are over there? Is there sort of a comparable scenario where they take notice?
Yes, they do have really sensitive areas that they don't like when U.S. warships are in the region. One of them is up in the Barents. So that's, you know, around, this is in the Arctic Circle. This is very close to the Russian Northern Fleet, which is where they keep their best ships and their best submarines. A lot of them are nuclear submarines. They have a lot of sensitivity about NATO warships in that area. They'll typically come out and shadow them and be around and maybe even harass them. The same holds true for a similar area in the Pacific Ocean near Japan, where it's a sensitive area for the Russian Navy. The third place, which hasn't been the case since the war in Ukraine started, is the Black Sea. And the Black Sea is currently, Turkey is, you know, has something called the Montreux Convention, where they can prevent warships from coming in and out. And so we have not, the United States Navy has not had a warship presence in the Black Sea for 2 years. But when we were sailing in there, the Russians were highly responsive and highly reactive and pretty aggressive to our ships who were operating in that area close to Crimea.
Dara Masico is a senior fellow in the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. People in southern Brazil are still recovering from devastating floods. An estimated 2.3 million people are directly affected. The floodwaters have now largely receded, but in their wake, there are serious public health concerns. Dengue fever, respiratory illnesses, and a bacterial disease that's already killed more than a dozen people. Michael Fox reports from the southern Brazilian city of Porto Alegre.
Baltazar Covelo Cunha is a volunteer aid worker in a gray wool sweater and a bright yellow life vest. Today, he's taking a medic to treat people who have weathered the floods in an archipelago in the middle of the Guaíba River. Some areas are still underwater. It's drier now, but the water was over the tops of these homes, he says, pointing to houses that are still partially submerged. We drove over these houses in a boat. Cunha himself used to live here. He lost everything to the floods. He's since dedicated his life to the aid effort. In the first days of the tragedy, he was in the water helping to save people's lives. That's how he got leptospirosis. It's a bacterial disease spread by coming in contact with infected animal urine or contaminated water. I ended up ingesting some of the water, he says, and it created a big wound on my lip, really swollen, and a lot of diarrhea. Cunha says the doctors gave him some steroid injections plus a round of antibiotics. It helped. Others who contract leptospirosis are not so lucky. The symptoms can take weeks to appear. The bacteria can attack vital organs, causing fever, renal failure, jaundice, hemorrhaging, and trouble breathing. So far, there are more than 4,000 suspected cases across the state. 17 people have died. Magdalena Machado is a flood victim who lost everything on the islands. Her neighbor died of the bacterial disease. That's why she doesn't want to go back home.
A gente prefere não arriscar a vida, né? Bem materiais vão e vêm.
We prefer not to risk our lives, she says. Material things come and go, but our lives and our health are the most important. You have to try to protect yourself. Alexandre Zavascki is an emergency doctor in Porto Alegre who has treated flood victims since the beginning of the tragedy. The question of leptospirosis is important because it can be very serious in any patient, he says. Not just fragile patients who already have multiple illnesses, but the disease also affects very healthy people. He says right now is a major concern for leptospirosis because the waters have dropped, so the bacteria is in higher concentrations in the water and mud that was left over. That includes in homes that were inundated and which people are now cleaning out. Streets across the region are lined with piles of furniture and clothes destroyed by the floodwaters. We see there's a lack of equipment for people to clean their homes, says Zavascki, especially with the mud everywhere. And they're cleaning without boots, suitable pants and gloves that protect against the direct contact of the water with the skin. Leptospirosis is not the only illness fueled by the flood. At shelters across the state, medical professionals say they've seen high rates of diarrhea and stomach infections due to exposure from the contaminated waters. There's also been dengue and a huge spike in the flu, which has spread fast among shelter residents. Jeruza Nayalov is an epidemiologist at the Federal University of Rio Grande do Sul who's treated patients in a shelter on campus for weeks. We're in a moment of respiratory illnesses, she says. It's winter and everyone is together in one place, in a shelter, which are not the ideal conditions. In many homes and neighborhoods across the region, there is still a sick stench of rot, decay, sewage, and mildew. There are fears that even once people do return home and clean everything out, respiratory diseases may linger, as it could take weeks or months for everything to truly dry out. But heavy rains are again in the forecast. Everyone is worried that the water will rise again, engulfing city streets where the rubble has yet to be cleared, prolonging the tragedy and the toll. For The World, I'm Michael Fox, Porto Alegre, Brazil.
Hong Kong has a unique judicial system, and it's linked to the fact that the Chinese territory was ruled by Britain for 156 years. In 1997, when Britain handed back Hong Kong to China, it was agreed that foreign judges, alongside local ones, would sit on the bench of Hong Kong's highest court. But now, 3 out of 10 foreign judges have decided to resign from the Court of Final Appeal. 2 are British and 1 is Canadian. One of the judges said he was stepping down because Hong Kong is slowly becoming a totalitarian state. Tom Grundy is the editor-in-chief of the Hong Kong Free Press and has followed all of this closely. Tom, who are the judges that are quitting?
Well, the UK's Lord Lawrence Collins, he quit citing the political situation. Canada's Beverly McLaughlin said she'd retire next month while saying she had confidence in the rule of law. But it was the UK's Lord Sumption, Jonathan Sumption, who quit and wrote an explosive letter to the Financial Times about what he saw as Hong Kong slowly becoming totalitarian. He called a recent judgment against 14 Democrats legally indefensible. He said judges' freedoms have been severely limited. And he spoke of an oppressive atmosphere and paranoia among the authorities. And bear in mind, since the 2019 democracy protests and unrest and the enactment of 2 controversial security laws, Hong Kong has seen most of the opposition put behind bars or self-exiled, newsrooms raided, security law trials with handpicked judges, thousands of protesters prosecuted, elections restricted and a protest song and slogan banned, whilst dozens of civil society groups have disbanded. All this whilst the authorities say they're restoring stability, maintaining freedoms, and preventing a repeat of what they are now deeming foreign-backed riots.
It's interesting, though, because why is Lord Sumption quitting now as opposed to earlier? I mean, you just reeled off a ton of events that have happened over this past several years. Why now instead of before?
Yeah, many wonder what took so long. He told the BBC this week that he wanted to see how things develop, leaving a lot of critics and lobby groups who've been pressuring these judges to ask, why did you stick around for 5 years? He's had this role since 2019. And of those who have spoken who are remaining, they reckon that they can have a tempering effect and have openly backed the judicial independence and rule of law that Hong Kong hopes to continue to cherish.
How has China responded to all this?
Beijing today attacked Sumption as smearing the national legislature, accusing him of being a tool of London and a bid to interfere and destroy Hong Kong's stability. So the spotlight now is on the remaining 7 judges from Australia, the UK and South Africa. But of the ones we've heard from, they are singing from the same hymn sheet as these judges have in recent years and saying that there is rule of law, there is judicial independence and that they will be continuing.
Tom, you're British. You're the editor of a Hong Kong publication. You live in Hong Kong. Are you ever nervous you could be targeted with the national security law?
That's something I'm asked about all the time. And of course, press freedom wise, we've seen newsrooms raided, over 1,000 journalists out of work, and journalists behind bars for the first time. Certainly a lot of my bandwidth is navigating those red lines, keeping the team safe, and that is the number one priority. We're fiercely impartial, but, you know, we find that on balance, there is more reasons to stay, to go to the legislature, to bear witness at the court, to ask tough questions of officials, privileges that you wouldn't get if you're outside of Hong Kong. We would lose the accuracy and the nuance. We wouldn't be able to speak to Hong Kongers. And certainly you can't do any of what we're still able to just about do in mainland China, just to the north. So, you know, we talk about occupying the remaining space, but it's not to say that we haven't also seen, you know, low-key harassment, you know, instances of surveillance and pressure, direct and indirect, over the 9 years that we have managed to continue running. But I would say we're the only English language, truly independent news outlet still going in the city.
Tom Grundy is the editor-in-chief of the Hong Kong Free Press. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Adults in the UK want to be more connected to nature. That's what a recent poll from the Agency for Nature suggests. That's a group that's trying to get British ad agencies to focus on getting people outdoors. And one of their latest projects is aimed at a specific group of young people, as The World's Bianca Hillier explains.
Video games are full of imagination. Players can take shape as otherworldly creatures in faraway universes. But in fact, many games are inspired by the real world, including Guild Wars 2. The game is set among forests, caves, and mountains, with plants helping players advance.
Some you have to have as like an item to make a weapon.
Hannah Young lives in London and loves gaming in her spare time. She knows there's a pervasive idea about gamers, that they never leave their basement and actually, quote, touch grass. Young says it's simply not true.
I like to go for walks and being outside, and you can be a gamer and have like a really big affection for nature.
That's what Young and her colleague Alex Antanasovsky have sought to prove. They work at the advertising agency Wyden and Kennedy and recently launched a campaign called Seed Saga, which allows video game users to plant flowers from the game Guild Wars 2 in their own real garden.
So we've got flax, crimson sunflower, and blooming passiflora. In the game, they all kind of have different abilities, and they're all in really different parts of the map.
Gamers who wanted the seeds had to submit an application and explain what the plants would mean to them. And Tanisovsky says the responses were way more emotional than expected.
A lot of it were like, this plant reminds me of my girlfriend and how we met in the game. So it was actually like super nice, like, to take the time to look at all the answers.
700 people wrote in, and only 30 were able to get the free limited edition packs. Both Antanasovsky and Young believe part of why the idea has been so successful is because the seed packs are like merchandise that gamers typically vie for.
It comes with a soil card.
A soil card is one of those tiny plastic signs you put in the soil to tell what plant is growing there.
We kind of wanted it to be like a collectible card that you kind of have like a Pokemon thing that you'd want to keep. So you can watch your plant grow and it's still got that item to cherish.
For example, the soil card for the blooming passiflora details its healing powers in the game and its abilities in real life, like how it's known to treat indigestion. But Seed Saga isn't the first project emphasizing nature and climate in the context of video games. Users rave about the landscapes in Red Dead Redemption 2. It's such a focus point of the game that researchers say players end up with a better knowledge of wildlife than people who don't play. There's also an upcoming game out of the Netherlands called All Rise, in which users play climate lawyers in court. Game developer Joost Vervoort described it on the podcast Get Played.
All Rise is a game that was born out of real climate activism, and it's a game that is about taking fossil fuel industry giants to court.
Back in London, Alex Antenasovsky says her team's Seed Saga project helps redefine who a gamer can be.
You can just continue to game and actually contribute to nature.
Merging virtual and real worlds, one seed at a time. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The Dallas Mavericks are hosting Game 4 of the NBA Finals tonight, and Boston Celtics fans are pretty jazzed, to say the least, as their team is just one win away from another championship. Fans in Riga, the capital of Latvia, are also excited because one of their national heroes has played a huge role in this winning season for the Celtics. The World's Daniel Offman reports.
Kristaps Porzingis comes from a Latvian basketball family. He talked about that in 2017 during an appearance on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon.
My whole family played basketball. My older brother was a professional basketball player. My middle brother also played. My mom is 6'1", dad is 6'4", you know, I'm 7'3".
Porzingis was drafted into the NBA in 2015, and soon enough, people around the league started calling him the Unicorn. A unicorn is a ball player with a unique or almost unbelievable skill set.
Porzingis gets away inside and throws it down.
Are you kidding me?
What makes Porzingis unique is his extreme length combined with his ability to shoot deep three-pointers. In Riga, I met up with Giannis Painters, a former professional basketball player. Painter says he scrimmaged against Porzingis for the first time in 2017 when they were both on the Latvian national team.
For me, the funniest thing was probably when you are guarding him. He faces up, shoots over you, and I'm like 6'8", 6'9", almost. And I was like, well, what is this? Like, how is this possible?
Painters says that he and Porzingis hit it off and became friends. Painters is now one of his personal trainers. Porzingis had an all-star level season this year. But one thing that's plagued him has been his health. He's had multiple injuries throughout his career, and this year, early in the playoffs, it happened again. Porzingis strained his calf muscle, which kept him off the court for 10 games.
He was pretty down mentally because he understood what it means, you know. It was about him not getting hurt, and he got hurt in the playoffs, so he was obviously like a little bit depressed, you know.
A week ago, Porzingis made his return in Game 1 of the NBA Finals. The Boston crowd greeted Porzingis with a standing ovation. He went on to dominate the game.
Porzingis shooting, scoring. Kristaps Porzingis, 8 points in 5 minutes. Timeout, Dallas.
But now, despite the fairy tale return to the finals, the injury roller coaster ride with Porzingis continues. Following Game 2, he was ruled questionable after sustaining yet another injury. But that fact hasn't stopped Latvian fans from getting up in the middle of the night to watch the Celtics play.
Let's go Celtics!
In Riga, a group of about 10 Latvian basketball fans gathered to watch the 3:30 a.m. tip-off on a giant screen. They're disappointed that Porzingis is injured, but they're still bringing the passion. Some of them sport Porzingis jerseys or other Celtics paraphernalia. Reynis Kazaks is one of the organizers of this fan club.
You know, we are only 2 million people here in Latvia, and our guy in finals, super crazy.
Kazaks and some of the other fans here have traveled to the U.S. to watch Porzingis play in the NBA. Mix Galvanovskis, another fan here, says that because Latvia is such a small country, some of them have mutual friends with Porzingis or have met him before.
Kristaps know that we are watching here too, and we have a lot of good and common friends with him, and his name over here will never be forgotten, let's say like that.
All the fans here are confident that the Celtics will win the championship, but they also hope that their favorite player will come back tonight for Game 4. For The World, I'm Daniel Offman, Riga, Latvia.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening, and join us right back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. Macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Amy Rao and Harry Plant, Roman Mars, Dan Kletter, Frederica and Howard Stevenson, and the Mailman Foundation. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.